You're listening to the Fifth Estate podcast from the Wheeler Centre. In this episode, recorded at Federation Square as part of the 2018 Melbourne Writers' Festival, Sally Warhaft speaks to Russian-American writer Marsha Gessen.
Journalist and author, a staff writer with The New Yorker, the author of enough books to fill a shelf now, including, of course, The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, and her most recent book, the winner of the 2017 National Book Award and the subject of our discussion this afternoon, The Future is History, How Totalitarianism Reclaimed Russia. So please give Marsha Gessen a very warm Melbourne welcome.
Thank you, and it's great to be here.
The book tells the story of the past 40 years or so in Russia and how Russia turned away from democracy. And it's told in the way of a novel. I was just saying to Marsha, it even somehow feels like a Russian novel in the hands. It's big, it's got a little font. And enough characters that I wrote them down to keep track of.
But there's also a list.
There's a lovely list at the beginning too. I did my own with notes and family extensions and so on. Told through the lens of four main younger characters, all born in around the early 80s, and three older public intellectuals or academics who weave their way in and out of this story as well. I'd like to know, first off, Marsha, is it unreasonable of me to describe this as unrelentingly bleak?
Well, it may not be unreasonable, but it's ill-advised.
Good start. Because,
yeah. And the reason, I have had this explained to me. So when I started doing publicity for the book in the States, the publishing house got very concerned because I would go on the air and say, you know, it's hopeless, there's no future. And so they said, you know, don't use the word hopeless. I'm like, what should I use? Despairing? They said, no, not despairing. Use fascinating. So, no, unrelentingly bleak goes in the despairing column, but we'll just call it fascinating.
Okay. Now, look, let's start with these four younger people who, as I said, they were born in the 80s, they grew up in the 90s, they've lived their entire adult lives under Putin. Growing up, as you describe it, in a society that was shutting down. How did you go about choosing these four?
Right. So initially, once I had decided that I wanted to structure the book this way, through four people, and I wanted them to be born in... I wanted them to be born in the 80s, and I wanted them to remember the coup, the 1991 coup that... Actually, we just had the anniversary, the 27th anniversary of the 91 coup that failed to overturn Gorbachev's perestroika, but basically precipitated the collapse of the Soviet Union, or that part of the empire. And I wanted them to remember the coup, right? So that actually disqualified a number of people who grew up in the 90s. And I also wanted them to flesh out certain stories that I wanted to focus on. In particular, I wanted them to have had their lives changed profoundly by the crackdown that began in 2012. Because really the book was an attempt to explain how Russia could have gotten to the state that enabled the crackdown and how the crackdown proceeded. So I needed their lives to change profoundly in 2012. So as a result, two of them were active participants in the protests. One of them is the daughter of Boris Nemtsov, the politician who was murdered and who had been one of the organizers of the protests. And I'm referring to the mass protests of 2011, 2012 in Russia, the sort of failed revolution. And one of them was chased out by the anti-gay campaign that was very much at the heart of the crackdown. So I knew I needed one of them to be queer. And I also wanted them to represent different, and I hate actually the word represent, I wanted them to come from different socioeconomic classes, because another thing that I really wanted to flesh out was just the extremely rigid class structure that Russia inherited from Soviet society, which is, I think, something that comes as a surprise to most people in the West. Mm. And then they also had to be people who would be willing to talk to me for hours, and I mean like dozens of hours, and answer really absurd questions, like, because I wanted to write the book through their interior, right? There's no journalist in the book. They're just the voices in people's heads, and I wanted it to feel very close and a little bit claustrophobic at times. But that meant that I had to ask them to recount what they felt, what they smelled, what they saw, what they watched on television in those particular times in Russian history and in particular times in their lives. And not everybody has a high tolerance for that kind of questioning. I actually recently went through a similar experience and realized I have no tolerance for that kind of questioning. So there was actually someone else who was supposed to be in Jana's place, and the book would have been very different if she had been the person in that place. But the scheduling wasn't working. There was no way I was going to get that number of hours out of her. And there was also someone else who was going to be the gay character. And the problem there turned out to be different, which was that he is still living in Russia. And I realized he couldn't be open enough and sort of distant enough from what was happening to talk to me in enough detail.
Well, at least three of the four now are not in Russia, is that right?
Two of the four are not in Russia, yeah.
Right. Well, I'm glad you got Losha, because I found of the four, his character just the uh-huh. warmth and the struggle of how he expresses his story is just wonderful. Actually, this is a sort of more personal question, I guess. I kept thinking as I read it that the period when they were born was actually precisely the period where you left. And I was thinking about these four young people, that these were never kids you got to pass in the street, had any opportunity, you know, that they were babies that you never, that generation, you never saw grow up into their, you know, the first, say, decade. Did that occur to you as you were writing it?
You know, that's a really good point. It didn't occur to me in that exact way, and I love the way you put it. I think that I had thought about it. It's a very strange thing to, and I'm sure there are people in the audience who've experienced this, when you go back to a place where you missed a period of time. And I speak Russian without an accent. I started passing as soon as I went back. But my passing was really complicated because the country had changed so much in the decade that I was gone. I had emigrated to the United States with my parents in 1981 when I was 14. And I came back as a reporter exactly 10 years later. So there was a new language, there was new slang. There were television shows that I hadn't watched. There were a lot of words, I mean, really a lot of words that had come in with new reality, because when there's so much change, there are many new terms, right? And I didn't know them. And so I always felt like I was skating in very thin ice, but no one could tell. I was like a spy, right? And every so often I'd make a faux pas, but it never occurred to anybody that I was making it, because I was effectively a foreigner, mm-hmm. right? And I think that's part of what gave me my fascination with the condition of growing up in the 1990s. Right? I was already living there as a grown-up, but I was thinking what it was like for kids growing up in the 90s, whose parents might have been, or they were either sort of exhilarated by all the new opportunities in the 90s, or terrified by the instability that the 90s brought. And there is, I think, that dichotomy. But from the point of view of a kid, it doesn't matter whether your parents are exhilarated or terrified. It's unstable, right? And that sense of profound instability that I think I was perhaps more attentive to, because I couldn't naturalize it, right? I was still an outsider. It didn't happen to me the way it was happening to the people that I lived among. But the other thing about that instability was that there was a place of stability. There were Soviet films on television still. Right? Imagine, you know, this is the end of a totalitarian state. And so it's like a post-Nazi Germany where there's Nazi propaganda on TV. There's Soviet architecture everywhere. There are monuments to Soviet accomplishments on every corner. I mean, literally on every corner, right? There's hammer and sickle on every building, every official building. It's like walking among swastikas again in post-Nazi Germany. But that offered a kind of sense of stability and moral clarity and certainty that these kids were craving. And I thought that was hugely important to the book that I was trying to write. But I think what made me notice it was that, you know, I hadn't been around, right? So all of it was weird to me.
It's a really subtle thing. It's so personal, the book. You can feel it, and yet the word I is not in it. I didn't see it a single time. And I liked that sense I got, though, of you reaching for this sort of lost decade.
Thank you.
So let's now switch to this sort of intellectual stream that is the concurrent sort of thing that runs through these other characters and ideas. And, I mean, perhaps the most central character in the book is Homo Sovieticus. And this was it started with a philosopher, Levada, and his hypothesis that every totalitarian regime forms a type of human being on whom it relies for stability, and in this case, Homo Sovieticus. Tell us about this character.
So neither Homo Sovieticus nor Levada are actually in the book personally, because Homo Sovieticus is not a person, and Levada had died by the time I started writing the story. But one of his students, his sort of youngest and favorite, I think, student, is one of the main characters in the book. But Levada had this hypothesis that that the project, the Soviet project of creating new man, had in some sense succeeded. There was a set of adaptations that was ideal for surviving Soviet society. And so he had a hypothesis about what those adaptations were, and he also had the hypothesis that because state terror had actually ended in the mid-1950s, by the time that he was allowed to do his research, which is the late 1980s, Homo Sovieticus should be on its way out, because the adaptations were necessary for that state of state terror, whereas the sort of the late totalitarian society, or what Václav Havel called post-totalitarian society of the 1970s, it wasn't as brutal, right? So it didn't require the same thing. So he thought that they were going to find that Homo Sovieticus existed, but was generationally bound, and that it was dying out, and once it died out, and then the Soviet Union would collapse because Soviet institutions rested on Homo Sovieticus. And in the late 1980s, and this is one of my favorite stories in the book, is how they went about doing their research.
It's amazing.
Because this was a country where sociology had been effectively banned. So Levada had been running an underground seminar for 20 years. For 20 years, every 2 weeks, they would gather, and the participants in the seminar would report back on what they were reading in their assigned areas of Western sociology, so they would keep up on the discipline. And then in the late 80s, he was allowed to collect this group of people and do a study with them. And they realized that none of them had ever even seen a survey being conducted, because sociology wasn't allowed in the Soviet Union, and of course because none of them could, when it was sort of something resembling sociology was allowed a little bit, none of the Levada students were allowed to be anywhere near it. So they were up in theory, but it was like handing an academic neuropsychologist a scalpel and telling him to perform brain surgery. But the other thing was that they couldn't, there was no baseline. No one had done any study that could function as a foundation or even a precursor to their study.
When you stop and think about that for an entire society. It's mind-boggling what you don't have to reach back to,
right,
just to start right then and there.
And I think, you know, it's essential. I mean, it's a very circular thought that I'm trying to follow, but it's essential to a totalitarian society that it not know itself. So it wasn't an accident that there was nothing to reach back to. But they created this very, very long, very detailed survey in which they purposefully created these sort of provocative questions that they thought of as dynamite that would blow up the monolith of opinion and allow them to sort of find something in the material. And they came back with results that showed that, yes, Homo sovieticus existed. And the key characteristics of Homo sovieticus, the key characteristic was doublethink. It's the ability to always think two contradictory things at the same time and exist without tension between the two of them. We all think contradictory things, but generally speaking, we experience some sort of discomfort or tension because we're thinking contradictory things, and that tension is productive. But this was thinking on separate tracks, so identifying with the great state and feeling jilted by the state at the same time were a very good example, summed up in the Soviet saying, "We pretend to work and they pretend to pay us." Mm. And they concluded that it was generationally bound because they found more older people, they thought, who were Homo sovieticus, and they predicted that the Soviet Union would collapse, and then right on schedule, the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991. And then they found out they were wrong.
The student who does this work, whose name is Lev Gudov, who, you know, a truly remarkable, as an anthropologist, I just wanted to meet him, somebody who, first of all, was able to start it, to get a bank of information, I suppose, but also somebody who was willing to recognise that his, somebody who sounded like a sort of beloved sort of mentor to him, his teacher, was wrong, and to take that on, and somebody who, throughout the book, he's always willing to be surprised by what he sees.
It's such a wonderful thing to notice about him, but yeah.
Well, you don't see it amongst a lot of people in the social sciences who have all the benefits of standing on their master's shoulders, let alone some guy in Moscow trying to do this pretty much all by himself. You use his work throughout. You track his sort of five-yearly... Very Soviet, isn't it? That sort of five-yearly coming back to the questions. Tell us about some of the other, because they're so interesting, shifts that he found and that you write about in the book.
So in 1994, 5 years after they did their first survey, they went back and did the survey again. And again, it was very difficult because the country had changed, the Soviet Union had collapsed, so a lot of their questions that they had spent so much time thinking about and hoping that there would be a baseline. For example, the question, would you prefer that your boss be a member of the party? Which they were surprised by the results they got in 1989. They had assumed that ideology was very important because That's what we've always been told, both by totalitarian societies, but also by students of totalitarian societies, that ideology is a pillar of totalitarian society. And then they discovered that ideology was entirely unimportant to Soviet people and to the sort of the maintenance of Soviet institutions. And he has some very interesting ideas about why we're so wrong about ideology, but they couldn't ask that question anymore. There was no more party, singular. And that applied to many of the questions they had asked. But they went back in 94, they redesigned the survey, they did it again, and they were shocked by what they found, which was that Homo sovieticus hadn't gone anywhere, that actually the numbers had remained stable. And at the end of 1994, they started saying that they were afraid that something was terribly wrong, that the assumption that Russia was reforming itself, reconstituting itself, was erroneous. The thing for me that was also eye-opening about going back with him and looking at those studies, but also interviewing him about doing those studies, was that I had been working as a journalist in Russia. Gudkov had always been one of my informants, so I had been going back to him for years and years and years. And I must have talked to him about this. And I must have been not able to absorb that information.
Yeah, right.
Right? Which is something that, he may always be willing to be surprised. I like to think that I'm always willing to be surprised, but I think when you have no tools to understand something, it just goes right past you. And then I discovered that in 2000, 2001, he wrote an absolutely brilliant two-part article, basically a book, sort of revisiting the concept of totalitarianism and trying to update it for a society that had been totalitarian for many decades. Because the original definitions of totalitarianism all date back to a time when there was only one generation of people who'd lived under totalitarianism. And I missed that too. I don't remember reading that in 2000, 2001. But basically by that time, he was convinced that totalitarianism was exerting its revanche. And he was talking about it, and nobody was hearing him.
Mm. It's, you know, obviously attracted so much attention, the subtitle of your book. Although I sometimes have wondered, have people been really reading that carefully, how totalitarianism reclaimed Russia? Has it... what's your response to the irritation, I think, of a lot of people, of you using this word in a way that is not deemed appropriate by some?
Well, a couple of things. One is that I can always tell which reviewers read the book and which reviewers didn't get to chapter 14, which...
There's a whole chapter on it, chapter 14.
It sits right in the middle of the book, and it explains why I'm using that term. So I'm sad to say Francis Fukuyama did not get to chapter 14. The terms of totalitarianism actually also has a proud history of being debunked by Soviet scholars throughout its existence. There was a whole sort of movement, very, you know, dominant in Soviet studies especially in the 80s, led by the Australian scholar Sheila Fitzpatrick, who argued that the term totalitarianism couldn't be applied to the Soviet Union. So there's nothing new about this argument. And the thing is that I don't think it's a very compelling argument. I think that it's an argument that's based on sort of a very simple, almost unthinking application of the term, right? No term of description can ever be fully borne out by actual lived reality, right? And so the critique that Fitzpatrick and her colleagues generally used was that, you know, the totalitarianism had to be a monolith, and this country wasn't a monolith, so therefore it wasn't totalitarian. Well, that would mean that there's never been a totalitarian society in the history of the world, and the term is useless. But getting to what the book is not so much about the term totalitarianism, but it's about trying to think through what happens when a society has been totalitarian. And my argument is that what's happened in Russia is that totalitarianism shaped the institutions of that society, the informal institutions, shaped its culture, shaped its habits. And, well, I guess that got a reaction. And when Vladimir Putin came in, without the intention of restoring totalitarianism, without the intention of creating state terror, which we've always thought of as a pillar of totalitarianism, along with ideology, but he just wanted to get rich. He just wanted to build a mafia state. But once he started cracking down, society responded by reverting to the habits of totalitarianism. And so the lived experience of living in Russia now is the experience of living in a totalitarian society in the absence of a totalitarian state.
The idea that kept coming to my mind was a I don't know if you can make this analogy, if it's ridiculous, but it was almost like Russia as a sort of abused child, and dealing with the repercussions of that in adulthood.
Yes, exactly.
Thank goodness.
So one of the a really, really important moment that that sort of created the book was when I listened to a lecture that was delivered by a friend of mine on the psychology of trauma, and it was an odd kind of lecture. She was actually lecturing. She's a trauma psychologist, but she was doing a lecture for prosecutors who work with victims of human trafficking.
Right.
So she was talking to lay people and explaining really basic things. And as I listened to it, I thought, she's describing totalitarianism. When she's describing the mechanisms of control that people who these prosecutors worked with had applied to them, she was describing totalitarianism. So she was saying, you know, in order to, in a situation of trafficking, or any kind of abuse, actually, people have to be kept isolated. They have to be, at first, they're usually every step they take is controlled, but then there's a little bit more leeway. But they can't predict what's going to happen. There's an unpredictable system of reward and punishment. There's always a threat of violence that's credible.
But it doesn't have
but
to
doesn't
be
necessarily
widespread.
Apply to them. Mm. Yeah. And the thing that it robs them of is the ability to foresee a future, to envision any kind of future. And as I listened to that, I thought, oh my God, this is a perfect description. But it would probably be completely insane to try to take this scholarship that's done with individuals or small groups and apply it to an entire society, and I would be ridiculed. And then I started reading up on the psychology of trauma and realized that it originates with the study of totalitarian societies. That actually what we use now to understand what happens to victims of abuse, especially group abuse, was developed by people who were studying people who had been through brainwashing camps, through Korean and Chinese internment camps, people who had been through Nazi concentration camps. So exactly the thing that actually popped out at me when I was listening to that lecture. And so that's why there's also a psychoanalyst in the book.
And, I mean, she is so interesting as well. Her name is Marina
Arutyunyan.
And, I mean, she links so beautifully between Lev's sociology and what you're saying here in her own experience, doesn't she, of training to be a psychoanalyst in a country that's never had it. And the way you describe her, she has to go to Germany to actually get therapy, which is part of becoming a psychoanalyst, but this had to be done in English, which wasn't the language of either of her or her teacher. And there's something in and her story of, this whole place needs therapy more than almost anywhere you can think of, certainly while you're reading the book. And yet, again, there's no tradition of that to rely on. She came across to me as very sad. There was a tremendous sadness about her.
That's really interesting. I don't perceive her as sad. I think that she's reflected on a lot of disappointments. And I think that's probably difficult to read because most people cover up their disappointments.
Perhaps more an outsider. She's much more an outsider. A lonely character is probably a better way to explain it. Can you still hear me? Yes.
Yeah. I think that she's somebody that I can most relate to on a particular very, very important point of experience, which is she also experienced the 90s as this amazing decade of opportunity and creation. And it was a surprise to her, and I think a grave disappointment, that for most of her clients, the 2000s, when things started shutting down, came as a relief. That even people who were doing this very strange thing of seeking psychoanalysis in a place like Russia, where you weren't supposed to have inner conflict, and you weren't supposed to indulge in digging into your own soul. You can drink and complain about the pain in your soul, but no, you're not supposed to do that sober and on the couch. So even her clients really wanted to hand over their agency to what Eric Fromm calls the magic helper, the totalitarian leader that people want to take them away from this sense of unbearable freedom and unbearable unpredictability.
Mm. You write that there's no public in a totalitarian or post, totalitarian state. Can you talk more about that? Because that's one of the really important aspects of how you get to this argument, I suppose, to this point.
So, this was one of the problems, of course, with the sociological work, and it's a problem that has returned, which is how do you measure public opinion in a country that has no public and no opinions? The totalitarian state destroys the public sphere, destroys any space that's available for conversation, for debate, for an exchange of opinions. And the totalitarian state also robs people of the ability to form opinions. That's something that Hannah Arendt wrote about when she explained the difference between tyranny and totalitarianism. That a tyrant demands certain behaviors from people, maybe just demands the expression of certain opinions. But a totalitarian state aims to create total domination over people's beings and to erase the boundaries between people, forcing them into a one man of gigantic dimensions, as she puts it, and thereby it robs them of the very ability to form opinions. So there's no public, there's no opinion, and what do you do? Like, how do you create the ability to form opinions? How do you create the space for debate if it hasn't happened before?
Mm. And how do you, I suppose, not then become passive? I mean, do you think of Russia as passive?
I think it's probably fair to say that most societies are passive, primarily passive, right? Mm. Mm. But I think that in Russia, passivity was rewarded. I mean, that again, that's one of the hallmarks of a totalitarian society is that passivity is actually what gets you places. Mm. The squeaky wheel goes to the gulag. And that's, there are all sorts of ways in which behaviors of passivity are rewarded. And I think there's also, and I try to sort of both describe it and show it in the book, there's this whole sort of signaling culture where you have to always be on your toes to find out, and again, I think it's familiar from the way we think about abuse, right? You always have to be on your toes to understand which way the wind is blowing.
Yeah.
And then you need to try to get there ahead of the wind, and that's what's rewarded. Right, but what's rewarded is just trying to perceive what is expected of you, never actually agency, never actually action.
There are lots of examples in the book, too, of people, sort of very or subtly, sometimes less subtly, other to supporting the regime. That this is something Putin really, created again was this idea of. Making life difficult for. There's an incredible story of one of the young people going to vote. Can you tell that little story or talk around it? Because that really stayed with me. Yeah.
Well, actually, this is one of the four young characters whose name is Serioja. My favorite, I mean, and it's actually even on the, in a sense, on the U.S. cover of the book. My favorite story in the book is what happens to him on the way to voting, which I think is maybe even more instructive. So he was actually living in Kyiv in Ukraine, and he had been brought up in a very political family where he was taught that it was his job to vote. So in 2008, when Vladimir Putin decided that he was going to have Dmitry Medvedev, then the prime minister, keep his chair warm for 4 years. Because what had happened was that he was at the end of his second term. The Constitution said that a president could only serve two consecutive terms. The Constitutional Court interpreted it rather creatively to mean that the president can only serve two terms consecutively, right? So that meant that he had just to step aside for 4 years and then he could come back and serve another two terms. Meanwhile, Medvedev, once he became president, lengthened the term in the Constitution from 4 to 6 years. So that's why we have Putin now and will for another 6 years at least. But even though Putin said openly that people should vote for Medvedev and it was clear that he was only stepping aside formally, still, Serioja felt that he needed to go and do his duty and vote. And so he flew to Moscow from Kyiv and he took the little bus to the nearest metro station, the subway station in Moscow, to take the metro into town. And there's a huge line. A line that would last an hour because it's this very crowded metro station where people come from the airport, and it makes no arrangements to accommodate all of them, even though none of them have the card. The system is a little bit like here, right? So you need to have the card in order to be able to get on the metro. So he stood on this line for an hour. And when when it was his turn, he asked for a 60-ride card, which was the maximum number that he could get. And then he went to the tourniquet and said, I have just stood in this line for an hour, and I have bought this card, and now please go ahead, I'm going to swipe you in, so you don't have to stand for 60 minutes. And he swiped four people in before a policeman was there and had arrested him. And then he had this incredible conversation with the policeman. And the policeman said, but you're not allowed to resell these cards. And Serioja said, but I wasn't reselling it. I paid full price for it. And so functionally, all these people were also paying full price for their rides. And the guy said, but no, but the cashier, the woman who sells the cards, might get in trouble because you're violating procedure. And he said, but which is really important because this sort of idea that you're always responsible for other people who might face a penalty because of your behaviors is key in totalitarianism. And so Serioja said, but she didn't do anything wrong and I'm not doing anything wrong. And so finally this young guy, exasperated, says, what do you think you are, God? And as Serioja remembered the story, he said, and at that point, I just felt this incredible calm because I realized the way this man thinks will never be accessible to me. And I will never be able to convince him to see what I see. And so he just walked back to the entrance, swiped himself in, handed the card to the first person he saw with the remaining 55 rides on it, and rode the metro. Mm.
He's so perceptive, this guy. There was another story of him at a protest rally, I think, where he talks about, you know, not wanting to be part of the ecstasy of it,
right.
Wanting to be, not wanting it to be political, really.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I don't know what to make of that, actually. I think that, I keep going back, and the book was partly my therapy for understanding what happened in 2011, 2012, because I was very much a part of those protests. I found them exhilarating. I found them incredibly hopeful. I really thought that I was going, that we're going to see regime change in Russia. Of course, part of the reason I thought that was because I had, as a reporter, I had covered several revolutions, and I knew that they felt like this. So I was convinced that this was going to feel this was going to be a successful revolution too, I never asked myself, what does an unsuccessful revolution feel like on the inside? The answer is, it turns out, it feels exactly like a successful revolution, except it fails. But I think actually, I mean, there were a lot of things that, there were a lot of ways in which those protests were handicapped by this culture of totalitarianism. And one of them, of course, is this deep distrust of politics. People understand politics to be, and this is something that is not unfamiliar to you all, right? That people understand politics to be something that's corrupt, something that politicians do, something that that other people do, something that that is only connected to electoral politics, right? They don't understand politics as a way of acting together, and as the process of creating agreement on how we inhabit space together. Mm. And so politics was only ever used as a derogatory term, even those during those protests. But if you decide that your protest is not political, I think you've already kind of doomed your revolution. Mm.
What did you learn about generational memory?
So this was another obsession of mine. Intergenerational trauma and intergenerational memory, and it's something that rooms very large in trauma psychology, but it's also something that I wanted to sort of narrate through the book, which is that the memory of the terror is so impossible for the entire Russian society that it affects everything that happens in it. As it happens, I think the story that tells how impossible it is best is actually a story told to me by Marina Arutyunyan, the psychoanalyst. And it wasn't supposed to work like this. Our interviews weren't actually supposed to contain that kind of personal information. It was an interesting... the whole experience of interviewing her was really kind of trippy because... we did our sessions by Skype once a week. So with a lot of the other people, I would fly to Moscow and we would spend a week meeting every day for an hour or two. And then I'd come back a couple of months later and do it again. But with Marina, we just got on the phone every week for 1 hour. And at the end of the hour, I would say, our time is almost up. And next time I want to talk to you about blank. Because she wanted time to prepare and sort of think of the cases that she had worked on, her patients, and figure out what to tell me. So one time we were talking, and she mentions her grandmother. And I had actually said, you know, I had floated this idea of the unpredictable future with her, and she said, you know, how unpredictable was it? Like, for example, could my great-grandmother have predicted that that four of her sons would die from the drink, and her daughter would become a member of the Academy of Sciences. Mm. She said she didn't even understand what it meant. She would just say, Nyura is a very important person. So I had to figure out what this meant, because there were only a couple of women members of the Academy of Sciences ever in Soviet history. And I thought, well, who is her grandmother? And I Googled it. I figured out who she was very, very quickly, of course, because she'd mentioned her nickname. And I realized that not only had she been a member of the Academy of Sciences, she had also been a member of the Central Committee. And I felt really bad for Googling. And so then I confessed, and I said, can we talk about your grandmother? And it turned out that her grandmother... she'd been a member of the Bolshevik underground before the revolution. She'd grown up very poor. She was then chosen as a teenager to study history and to become a history professor, because the Bolsheviks had to create an entire new cadre of professors. It was called the Red Professorship, right? To replace the old, wrong humanities scholars. And so she went to the Institute for the Red Professorship, and there she met her future husband. And they were both brilliant, and they were both madly in love, and they went to Germany to study German history, and they came back, and he became a Trotskyist. And he was arrested, and then he was released, and then he was arrested again. And while he was in the Gulag, before terror became as sort of pervasive as it later became, she was sent to Kazakhstan to try to bring him back into the fold of the party. And so he was released into her custody. And they spent 3 nights in a hotel room. And then she said, well, have you given up your erroneous ideas? And he said, no. And she said, okay, back to the Gulag you go. And he went back into the Gulag. He was executed. And she lived with the grief for the rest of her life. She was, she left diaries that were just absolutely heartbreaking. So here was this person who had become a victim of the regime by becoming a perpetrator. And I think that we don't have a way to think about that. Nobody does, right? When we think about other horrible regimes, we think about victims and perpetrators. But in the Soviet Union, and this is very much a goal of the totalitarian regime, is to erase the line between victims and perpetrators. Everybody is implicated, but not everybody is implicated equally. And also, as the historian of Soviet terror, Alexander Etkin, says, Soviet terror was suicidal. It wasn't directed at any kind of other. It was directed at ourselves. So to try to say, we did this to ourselves, and we're all victims, and we're all perpetrators, and not in equal measure, is, I think, too heavy and too complicated. And I don't even know if it's possible. And so people carry that memory, the memory of their families, the memory of their grandfathers who were perpetrators, their grandfathers who were victims, their grandfathers who were both, and don't know what to do with that memory.
You mentioned earlier that Putin, you know, got into it to make money. How aware is he now of the psyche of his country, would you say? Or does he just plunder on through and...
Yeah, I mean, your question kind of assumes that he's a thinking person.
Well, yeah, no, that's not like me to assume such a thing of leaders. Has he been... We haven't talked about the central bad guy in your cast yet, of course, which is...
Alexander Dugin.
Yes, who is sort of the Putin whisperer. But as he spent more and more years in office and had got more and more control, do you think, despite his lack of credentials, that he does have some understanding of the damage, that he's able to more directly take advantage of it for his own ends?
I think he's got very good instincts, but I also think that Russia, the more Russia sort of recreates the ways in which Soviet society functioned, the more it actually conforms to what he thinks a functioning society should be like. I mean, that's what he thinks should work, right? And I think it's actually interesting to observe his great admirer, Donald Trump, who also thinks that that's how things should work, right? And is continuously surprised that they don't work exactly the way that he expects them to, that he can't, you know, fire, or he shouldn't fire the independent prosecutor, or that the American intelligence agencies are expected to function independently of the executive branch, even though they're a part of it. That sort of thing doesn't make any sense to Donald Trump, who thinks that things should be simple, controllable, and vertical. And it makes perfect sense to Putin. And so I think that he has been very good, and he has had a lot of help in recreating, in making out of Russia something that makes more sense to him.
How similar are they?
I don't actually think that they're that similar. I think that In fact, we can observe how different they are. They're temperamentally opposite. Mm. Putin has absolutely no innate charisma, unlike Trump, who I think has a lot, right? Trump is raw emotion. Putin prides himself on being controlled at all times. I don't think he always is. In fact, he usually isn't, but that's his image of himself, is that he is totally controlled. But I think that they share certain things that all autocrats or aspiring autocrats share, which is how they use and abuse language, which is how they lie, which is how they think things should work. But I think there are many, many others who work that way too, right? So my my credentials of having written about Putin and being therefore qualified to write about Trump, I think are perfectly well matched by the credentials of people who wrote about Berlusconi for many years. Mm. I think they also see things in Trump that are recognizable and that they can shine a light on.
Mm. We will have time in a moment just for one or two questions. We have to be right out on the dot today because of another session, but one more from me and then I'll throw over. This quote from your book: in the contemporary American imagination, Russia has reclaimed the role of evil empire and existential threat. And I think that's probably true in the Australian imagination too. That probably suits Putin down to the ground.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, your sense of where this might go. I mean, I feel slightly frightened asking you. To see nuclear clouds and.
Oh, it's fascinating. I don't know.
Good.
I don't think I'm qualified to make predictions. I think I'm sometimes qualified to describe things that I see. I think that I've benefited from having catastrophic imagination in the last couple of years because, for example, when I saw Donald Trump, I thought, oh, he's getting elected, obviously. But, I actually don't get a lot of credit for thinking that because he won by 77,000 votes in three counties in the United States. He lost the popular vote by nearly 3 million. There was no great value to my prediction. What made my journalism different from some other people's was that I thought it was conceivable that he would win, right? So I think that terrible things are conceivable, but that doesn't mean that they're going to happen.
Mm. Anybody with a burning, yep.
Okay, so really quickly, many pundits would say that perhaps Putin's relationship with Hillary and the head of the American embassy, the ambassador in 2012,
Michael McFaul,
that their actions during 2011 and 2012, during the elections, to some extent foster democracy, poll watch, et cetera, Putin took direct offense at and felt they were trying to actually overturn his win. Is there, and therefore his anti-Hillary was part of what went on in 2015 and 16, outside of all the issues of just trying to mess everything up in America. Did Putin have some right to say that?
Americans love to think that everything in the world happens because of America. I don't think that's true, right? I think that, yes, absolutely, he found Hillary Clinton, he thought of her as his own personal mortal enemy, in part because she is a woman that he would have had to deal with as being the most powerful man in the world, right? So that was an existential threat. Or he experienced it as an existential threat. Everything else was secondary. I don't think that, Russia's decline into its current state was caused by American meddling in the 1990s. There was meddling, I think it would be, or there was participation, right? I think it would benefit Americans to think about why we find it acceptable and desirable to openly try to influence other countries' elections, but it is not. It is clearly evil to try when somebody has a stake in American elections. But again, I think those are kind of footnotes.
Marcia, I hope I know you've been able to give the audience a sense today of the complexity of this book. It is an amazing book, and you don't have to be an expert in any way on Russia, as I am not, in order to gain something. It's a book only you could have written.
Thank you. I think it's probably true of most books.
Well, no. It's most of your books, maybe.
No, but I mean most of books that people
sadly
read.
Sadly not. I wish that was more true, but it's really not. Everything else in the book is true. I'd like to thank you all for coming along today. It's been just fascinating. Please come back to Melbourne soon. Marcia Gessen.
Thank you very much.
Sally Warhaft and Marcia Gessen, live at Federation Square for the 2018 Melbourne Writers Festival. There's plenty more from the festival coming up and, of course, plenty of episodes of The Fifth Estate too. Plus, you can catch some of these discussions on video at wheelercentre.com. We'll be back in your podcast feeds very soon. Until then, take care.